Lecture 19, The Origins of Chinese Buddhism.
For the last three lectures, we've been talking about the Buddhism of Tibet. That's been the focus of our discussion and the point, really, of our first expansion of discussion of Buddhism beyond India. But the truth is, we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves because Buddhism had been in China for over 500 years by the time Buddhism actually entered Tibet. So the focus of our attention in this lecture and the lecture that follows will be the process of transformation that took place in the first few generations, amongst the first few generations of Chinese Buddhists, as they attempted to adapt the Buddhist tradition to all of the complex, ancient, and venerable traditions of China, and in the process to meet the very distinctive needs of the Chinese people and the needs of Chinese culture. Now, when Buddhist monks first began to appear in the Chinese capital in the middle of the second century of the Common Era, quite a bit before Buddhism entered Tibet, China was coming to the end of one of the most expansive periods in its history. During the Han Dynasty, that lasted from 206 before the Common Era to 220 of the Common Era, China was stable and it was prosperous. It was a good place to live, actually. It was one of the most wonderful times, really, in the history of Chinese civilization. New lands were constantly being opened up for development. There were advances in technology and the arts. And for the upper classes, at least, it was a time of tremendous optimism and luxury. Probably wasn't too bad, actually, for the peasantry as well, because China was stable in that time, and they could confidently expect that the crops they planted in the springtime, they might actually benefit from in the fall. So China was a prosperous place and a stable place in a very classic Chinese style. And with the prosperity of Han China came the ideological synthesis that we know as Han Confucianism. Starting from the teaching of the ancient sage Confucius, Chinese scholars had created a vision of heaven, earth, and human society as a single harmonious whole. At the center of this cosmic order stood the emperor, the ruler of China, observing all of the prescribed rituals and civilizing his people through the cultivation of proper behavior and moral virtue. Key Confucian values in the Han period had to do with values that I suspect most of you know and would associate with traditional Chinese civilization. Filial piety, respect for elders, basic Chinese value, deeply rooted in the Confucian tradition, and particularly important in the stable structure of Chinese society during the Han Dynasty. Another important Chinese value had to do with a sense of harmonious, sensitive, and respectful relationships with other people. This value we call in English these days goodness or humanity. It's a particular Confucian value that's found in the ancient texts, and it's important really throughout the Confucian tradition, right through to the present day. Another important Confucian value had to do with the respect for proper ritual and the civilizing effect that rituals had on ordinary human interactions and human behavior. Now, this vision of society is probably familiar to a lot of you, and I may not have as much trouble expressing it to you as I would have expressing it to my freshmen at Boston University, but you can imagine when I talk to a class at 9 a.m. as they slouch down in their chairs and sip a little on their coffee cups, that this great Confucian model of a harmonious society tied together by bonds of respect and the proper performance of simple social rituals just doesn't kind of connect. There's something about this that seems a little bit strange and a little bit foreign, especially to the adolescent imagination. So there's a challenge in the classroom often to try to come up with an image, an example, a model that we can use to try to understand why this actually might be important to do. an important value to learn. I often try to get people to imagine what it would be like to go to their first job interview. This is an example that was actually taught to me by some of my Confucian teachers, so I'm not straying too far from the tradition itself. When you go to your first job interview, you're trying to imagine what it would be like to fit in a harmonious but somewhat respectful and strong way into a human organization that you want to play a productive part in. First thing you have to do is you open the door, walk into the room, and meet an interviewer is simply shake hands. You got to shake hands. And imagine what that simple ritual actually involves. It conveys a lot from one person to another in our culture. You want to have a firm handshake. You want it to last just the right amount of time. It has to convey a sense of respect to the other person, but also a sense of self-respect and stability in yourself. A lot can be conveyed by just simply that basic gesture of human relationship. In this Confucian vision of the world, society is made up out of millions of little interactions like that, where there is a certain understood, prescribed way of doing things, a good way to express respect for the other person and also at the same time express a certain sense of self-confidence and groundedness and wisdom about your own position in the world. And it's not too far-fetched to imagine that this is something that a freshman might want to cultivate a little bit in college, not just have all the fun that you want to do as you go out and leave the classroom and, well, I won't even speculate about what people do when they leave the classroom. There, of course, is a lot of that in college. But there also is an opportunity to develop a sensitivity to some of these basic rituals that tie human society together. It was really out of this simple insight that Confucianism flourished during the Han Dynasty. It obviously is based on an assumption that society is rather stable and there are roles that are prescribed for us that we can play with a certain degree of gracefulness and effectiveness. When society begins to fall apart, then a lot of this stuff is up for grabs. And that's what happened at the end of the Han Dynasty and created an opportunity for the coming of Buddhism. In the middle of the second century, the Han synthesis began to fall apart in ways that are pretty easy to understand. The emperor became weak and came under the influence of a lot of rival factions in the court and also in the countryside. He no longer had the power or the moral force. This is as important as the physical power to guarantee the legitimacy of the state. And as factions struggled for power, the peasantry, the common people, who in some ways are really the backbone of Chinese society, became increasingly alienated and oppressed. Eventually, a great rebellion broke out that caused tremendous turmoil in the rural regions of China and was suppressed with great bloodshed and seriously weakened the empire. And as far as the intellectuals go, they looked for new ways to diagnose and to respond to what they perceived to be the moral malaise of the times. They no longer could really give the same kind of respect and credibility to old ways of thinking about Chinese society as the structure of Chinese civilization simply disintegrated around them. So China was really ripe for the introduction of new ideas, even ideas as foreign as Buddhism. And it's hard to imagine a system of ideas that could be as strange in relation to traditional Chinese ways of thinking as the tradition of the Buddha from India. So as Buddhist monks and travelers and merchants made their way up into China as they moved over the mountains in Afghanistan and into Central Asia and as they came across the great trade routes through the Silk Road and began to communicate Buddhist ideas in a Chinese setting, they faced several obvious but difficult barriers. First of all, Sanskrit and Chinese were radically different as languages and as systems of thought. We've talked about Sanskrit really as a complex language capable of expressing quite sophisticated philosophical distinctions. Chinese is much more down to earth. It's monosyllabic, doesn't have all of these long words like the Sanskrit word pratityasamutpada or the name of Avalokiteshvara or any of those long Sanskrit terms that we've thrown around in our discussion of Indian Buddhism. So it was difficult initially to try to find a way in Chinese to express some of these Sanskrit ideas. Chinese also had nothing that corresponded to the complex psychological analysis in traditional Buddhism. All the different ways of dividing up the personality or dividing up the process of enlightenment into so many stages. That level of complexity simply didn't exist in Chinese civilization and was foreign to Chinese ways of thought. And more importantly, Chinese social values emphasized the family and the local community. They weren't as concerned as the Buddhists were with universal systems of values, and they weren't as focused as the Buddhists were on the rejection of the family in order to achieve an individual ideal of salvation. Now, the earliest Buddhist translators and missionaries in China tried to deal with these problems in different ways. Sanskrit and Chinese terms often were matched with one another, so people would try to pick out of the language of Chinese philosophy or of Chinese culture a term that might roughly correspond to some Sanskrit term. So the key Buddhist ideas could be matched with ideas that already were familiar to Chinese audiences. Often in the process, as you can imagine, offensive ideas sort of get dropped. You know, there's some funny little wrinkle in traditional Indian Buddhism that just isn't going to fit with a Chinese audience. Out it goes. Just drop it. And on the other hand, aspects of the Indian tradition that were congenial to Chinese tastes tended to rise in prominence. This is a process, actually, it's very interesting to observe. When we were talking about the Bodhisattva back in our initial discussion of Indian Mahayana Buddhism, I mentioned a Bodhisattva by the name of Vimalakirti, a layman, lived the life of a layman, and also managed to bring into his ordinary lay life a profound understanding of emptiness and the teaching of the Buddha. Now, the truth is, there are lots of Bodhisattvas in Indian literature. There are tons of them. I could have selected out of that vast literature all sorts of people to focus on, but I plucked out Vimalakirti in part because that's one of these characters that the Chinese focused on. He's one of the people that they plucked out because he embodied for them precisely that combination of familial virtue, a respect for community, embeddedness within the social order, and also at the same time a sense of wisdom and freedom and understanding of the truths that are expressed in the awakening of the Buddha. So Vimalakirti loomed large in the development of Chinese Buddhism. Now, as we look at the adaptation of Buddhism in China more generally, one of the key factors that made it possible for Buddhism to move as effectively and sympathetically into the Chinese cultural world as it did was a close relationship between Buddhism and the indigenous Chinese religious tradition of Taoism. As the Han Dynasty disintegrated, Chinese intellectuals often turned for their inspiration to the Taoist tradition. Taoism was comparable in its antiquity to the tradition of Confucius, and it often represented an opposite pole in Chinese thinking to the Confucian tradition with its active emphasis on public virtue and family values. In contrast to the active public character of Confucianism, Taoism advocated a strategy of inactivity, of withdrawal from the world, and contemplation. You can imagine that the Buddhists would have found this very congenial and very familiar. The Taoist way, or the Tao, was down to earth, it was natural, it was harmonious, and it was inexpressible in words, was something that had to be discerned, as it were, experientially in particular situations, rather than being expressed by broad conceptual distinctions. You can get a taste of Taoist teaching, and I think you can begin to sense the kinship between Taoism and Buddhism. If I simply read a few passages from the Tao Te Ching, one of the fundamental texts of the Taoist tradition, I'll read a couple of these passages and comment on them. We can think about them together. Chapter 1, the very first statement in the Tao Te Ching, is one that's perhaps familiar to you. The Tao that can be told of is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the origin of heaven and earth, and the named is the mother of all things. Here you can see that the Taoists were skeptical of any attempt to express ultimate reality in names. And this skepticism fits really well with Buddhist attitudes toward ultimate reality, whether it's in the form of no self or in the form of emptiness. What the Buddhists are saying is that there is no permanent identity in anything that you can pin a name on and expect to pin down. So the Taoist emphasis on the nameless, the inexpressibility of ultimate reality, fit beautifully with this aspect of Buddhism. But you can also see that the Taoists like to think of the Tao as the ultimate source of things, out of which everything comes. This is odd from a Buddhist perspective. You remember the story of Malunkyaputta and the arrow, when Malunkyaputta asked the Buddha to explain where the world came from. And the Buddha refused to get into any kind of a discussion about the origin of things. He was much more concerned, as Buddhism is, with analyzing the suffering we experience right now and finding some way to get rid of it. So the Taoist emphasis on seeing the Tao as the source had a subtle effect on Buddhism. It changed a bit the way it was understood and expressed in a Chinese environment. Now, pushing further into the text, when Taoists talk about the Tao, they also share a Buddhist reverence for simplicity and especially for images of negation and images of non-being. Let me read a couple of passages that express this idea as well. Chapter 4, the Tao is empty like a bowl. It is empty like a bowl. It may be used, but its capacity is never exhausted. It's bottomless, perhaps the ancestor of things. It blunts its sharpness, it unties tangles, it softens its light. It becomes one with the dusty world. Now, these first two lines, just to sense the subtlety of this interaction that's going on here, let me read them again. The Tao is empty like a bowl. It may be used, but its capacity is never exhausted. It's a classic statement about the Tao. And Nagarjuna once said, everything is possible for someone for whom emptiness is possible. Nothing is possible for someone for whom emptiness is not possible. Emptiness, possibility. Emptiness, inexhaustible possibility. It's present in both passages. You can see the buzz that these passages set up as you put them side by side, but you can also sense that the idiom is a little different. The worldview that produces these two statements, they have different implications, different suggestions. So Taoism and Buddhism have a natural kinship, but it also will be deeply transformative of Buddhism to translate it into this Taoist form. Another chapter in the Tao Te Ching that works in a creative way with the image of non-being is chapter 11. 30 spokes are united around the hub to make it a wheel, but it is on its non-being that the utility of the carriage depends. Clay is molded to form a utensil, but it is on its non-being that the utility of the utensil depends. Doors and windows are cut out to make a room, but it is on its non-being that the utility of the room depends. Therefore, turn being to advantage and turn non-being into utility. Classic Taoist statement about the importance of the empty space, the empty space in a room, the empty space in a spoon, or the still empty space at the center of a revolving wheel. Again, you can see very suggestive ways for Buddhism to translate itself into Chinese vocabulary. You can imagine, I suspect, that Buddhist eyes simply lit up when they heard this passage and this positive reference to the idea of non-being. Now, the Taoist tradition also had a very strong tradition of sagehood, like the tradition of sainthood or monastic practice in the Buddhist tradition in India. I'll read you a couple examples of that. The best person is like water. Water is good. It benefits all things and does not compete with them. It dwells in lowly places that all disdain. That is why it is so near the Tao. The sage is also natural. This is something we haven't heard about in India, but it's an important idea in the Taoist tradition. Let me read you a distinctive expression of this aspect of Taoist practice. There is a kind of sage who emulates the wisdom of nature. His method of teaching and transforming are like the relationship between a form and its shadow, a sound and its echo. Where there's a question, there's an answer. Where there's an action, there's a reaction. Body and spirit are in harmony. When he is at rest, there is no sound. When he moves, he leaves no trace. Therefore, he is able to bring those who are muddled and confused back to the natural Tao. Those people who believe that one's body is the temple of one's soul may well enough be good people. But the person who is able to go beyond his corporeal form is the true companion of nature. Only the selfless person can live up to the standards of nature, because your body is just one temporary form in nature's constantly changing process. Here you have selflessness, the idea of moving through the world and leaving no trace. It's very similar to the Buddhist idea of leaving no karma, of course, of nirvana. And yet this idea of naturalness, of flowing with the natural movement of the world, we haven't seen that before. That's not an important way of talking about nirvana or the life of a monk or nun in the Indian tradition. So again, very close kinship, but also a subtle possibility of a shift in values as Buddhism enters this Chinese world. Now, another important idea in this tradition, the Taoist tradition, is the idea of wu wei, or no action. The text, the Tao Te Ching, says, Tao invariably takes no action, and yet there is nothing left undone. And it says, the softest things in the world overcome the hardest things in the world. Non-being penetrates that in which there is no space. Through this I know the advantage of taking no action. Few in the world can understand the teaching without words and the advantage of taking no action. Now, as I say these words, I suspect that you have been listening to my discussion of Taoism with a certain degree of sympathy and probably with a certain degree of understanding, but also wondering at the same time how some of these great abstractions actually come down to earth, especially with the idea of no action. It's a concept that is perhaps appealing in its abstraction, but difficult to see how it comes down to earth. So I find when I'm working with students on a concept like this, it's important to start talking about some serious examples. It's like, get real, Eckel. Tell me a little bit about how this idea might actually come down to earth. One of the best stories that I think reflects this idea of Taoist no action and also the idea of no conceptual distinctions that really lies behind it is a story of a Taoist farmer who loses his horse. This is a poor farmer out there in the countryside somewhere, wherever it is. I suppose we could make up a setting to locate him somewhere in the world. He has one horse and one son. And the horse runs away and it's gone. And his neighbors come up and say, "Oh my God, this is the worst thing that I could possibly imagine. Your horse is gone. How are you going to plow the field and plant the harvest?" And the Taoist farmer says, "We'll see. We'll see." The next day, the horse comes back and it's followed by 10 wild horses. And he rounds them all up and he puts them in the corral. And the neighbors come and say, "Whoa! That's the most incredible thing we've ever seen. Yesterday you didn't have any horse. Today you've got 11 of them. What are you going to do now?" He says, "We'll see." And the next day, his son goes out to break some of the wild horses and gets thrown off the horse. Breaks his hip. The neighbors come and say, "Oh, this is the most terrible thing we've ever seen. You need your son. He's your only son. You need him to plant the fields and to work for you as you become old. What are you going to do now?" And he says, "We'll see." And the next day, you begin to get the drift of the story here, I suspect. And the next day, the emperor's draft board comes through town and drafts every able-bodied young man in the village and leaves the young man who has just broken his limbs. And the neighbors come in and say, "Well, this is the most fantastic thing that's ever happened. What are you going to do now? This is fabulous. Let's all go celebrate." And he says, "We'll see." And at this point, I suppose you could say that the story goes dot, 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 dot. You can continue it, I suppose, indefinitely, because the point is that any time a situation seems to present itself as having a particular meaning, you always have to be aware that there will be another side of it, viewed from some other perspective. This is really Taoist wisdom, not to leap to too many conclusions, but to just allow yourself to harmonize with the flow of events so that you take advantage of them in a natural way and don't try to turn them into something artificial that distorts them into something that they're really not. This is partly what the Taoists are talking about when they talk about no action. It's a certain sense of detachment and a certain sense of suppleness in the face of the flow of events. You can also see this, I think, in the practice of the martial arts. That would be another good example. Here in the West, when we fight with somebody, one of the things we like to do is attack them aggressively. But you know that in the Asian tradition of the martial arts, what you try to do as much as possible is to allow an opponent's strength to simply defeat the opponent. So you withdraw and allow the opponent's strength simply to exhaust itself. That's a kind of no action. It's no action with a very particular goal in mind, but it's choosing to withdraw from action rather than to aggressively attack a situation in some positive sense. Now, in the hard times that followed the fall of the Han Dynasty, Taoism obviously offered a very attractive option for the intelligentsia in China. It allowed them to pull back from what was a dangerous and difficult situation and flow to some degree with the flow of events. And it also, of course, was a great opportunity for Buddhists to begin to express themselves naturally in the vocabulary of this indigenous Chinese tradition. How did they do that? Well, initially anyway, in the very first translations of Buddhism into Chinese, the word Dharma was translated simply as the Tao. How do we express the Dharma? By the indirection of Buddhist teaching. The word Nirvana was translated how? What would be your guess? By the idea of Wu Wei, or no action, a kind of supple movement through the world that leaves no trace. So you can see how Taoist vocabulary offers great opportunities for Buddhism, but it also involves a subtle change in flavor and a change in the orientation of Buddhist values. So what are some of the changes that took place in Buddhism when it was expressed in Chinese terms? Well, I think on the positive side, first of all, we can see that Taoists shared with the Buddhists an ideal of sagehood and an ideal of wisdom. This is what the Taoists were seeking, and this is what the Buddhists sought. The sage also was detached from ordinary concerns of the world and could flow through them in a way that didn't cause suffering or hardship. The sage also harmonized with the Tao by avoiding extremes and seeking a balanced way of life, very similar to the Buddhist middle path. But Taoism also transformed Buddhism in a couple of very concrete and important ways. It made it much more pragmatic and down-to-earth, as Chinese civilization itself was. Buddhism often was very abstract and rarefied in its Indian form. Here it came down to earth. Taoism made Buddhism more concerned with natural ways of living, so that nature became an important concept in Chinese Buddhism in a way that had never been true in India. And finally, it made Buddhism much more amenable to a possibility of sudden enlightenment, not an experience that came in a rarefied way at the end of a long sequence of practice, but simply came in a wise acceptance of the situation in which we are presently located. So Taoism provided a great opportunity for early Buddhism, for the early Buddhists in China, and also involved a subtle transformation that will work its way out through the rest of Chinese and East Asian civilization.